Okay, welcome back. Apologies for the delay. Again, this is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of Atid and the webyeshiva.org with our ongoing effort to understand Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik's The Lonely Man of Faith. Thanks to the very engaging discussion last time, we did not get through the entirety of the fourth chapter. We'll try to finish chapter four and move on to chapter five. Finish chapter five today. Although I was very ambitious, I think, when we set out. Hold on a second. Let me see who else is online here. I was very ambitious when we set out. If you have a webcam, please hit the send video button. I had hoped that maybe we could, you know, cover the entirety of the work. But that's not going to happen before Web Yeshiva goes on break at Tisha B'Av time. So we're going to have to find a way to find a way to continue afterwards. So we will continue, but we're obviously in the next. I think we have three more weeks. Next week, Tuesday, is Shiv'Asar B'Tammuz, the 17th, the fast of the 17th of Tammuz. Here in Israel, the fast will already be over. I am planning, God willing, on teaching in all cases, although I know that some of you who are to the west of me, it will still be the fast. I am planning on teaching next Tuesday night, after Shiv'Asar B'Tammuz or during Shiv'Asar B'Tammuz, depending upon where on the planet you are. If you're unable to join us, of course, you can log in to the archives afterwards. Here we're talking about in the fourth chapter, we're on page 38 in the fourth chapter in this edition that we're using. We were talking about the community that Adam the First and Adam, the communities, the different types of communities that Adam the First and Adam the Second establish. The contrast between the two Adams comes into focus. Adam the First was not called to sacrifice in order that his female companion come into being. Again, let me just pull this up here one second. Here. Give me a sec. Here's our comparison. So, Bereshit Perek Aleph, Zacharon Ukeva Bara Otam. In the first account of creation, male and female are created simultaneously. Only in the second chapter is the story told that man is created individually, and then there's the declaration, Lo tov heyot adam levado, it's not good for man to be alone, Eselo ezer kenegdo, and Eve is created subsequently. Marriage, and remember it's important to point out, this was the original talk on which this essay is based, was a project funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, called the Marriage and Family Project. And probably this idea of the nature of marriage and the covenant of marriage and what it means to enter into a relationship like that may have been, in the oral presentation, may have been even more front and center. We don't have transcripts of those talks on which this was based. We don't have recordings of them. But one imagines that was the entree, the point of entry into the discussion of that particular forum in which the conversation was first the discussion was first made. Adam the First was not called to sacrifice in order that his female companion come into being. They're created simultaneously. You may be aware of the Rashi on that Pasuk in Genesis chapter 1 about what does it mean, Zacharon Ukeva Bara Utam. They were created together, simultaneously. If not, take a look at Rashi on that Pasuk. But because they're created simultaneously, there's no act of sacrifice on the part of Adam the First in order to allow the creation of Eve to occur. While it was indispensable for Adam the Second to give away part of himself in order to find a companion. the story of creation of Eve in Genesis 2, the story of the creation of a companion for Adam the second, is a story of sacrifice. He must give up something. I mean, in the literal tale, he has to give up a piece of himself in order to allow the creation of Eve. And Rabbi Soloveitchik interprets that as a community forming, a community fashioning gesture. The community fashioning gesture of Adam the First is, as I indicated before, purely utilitarian and intrinsically egotistic, and as such, rules out sacrificial action. You recall the personality of Adam the First. If, this is just an aside, if at this point these two different characters are in any way unclear to you, you should be reviewing what we've been learning. If you don't have it down pat, what Adam the First and Adam the Second, what they're each like, you need to go back and review. Adam the First is utilitarian. He forms community because it's in his interest to form community, because together the community of Adams the First can accomplish more than they can living as Robinson Crusoe. But there's nothing intrinsically wrong with being a Robinson Crusoe. So when they come together, they don't sacrifice anything in order to do that. It's like sharing a cab. When two people waiting on a corner trying to hail a cab realize they're both headed to the same place, it's just simply purely utilitarian for them to share it. It's in everybody's tachlis, their best interest, to share this cab, because it cuts down the cost for both of them. But it doesn't form a relationship. There's no covenant that is formed between the two cab sharers. It's just simply for very pragmatic purposes. For Adam the Second, communicating and communing are redemptive sacrificial gestures. Coming into a relationship with another person requires a type of sacrifice, a type of giving up something in order to gain something. And it's much different than the cab-sharing relationship of Adam the First that I just put forth. But for Adam the Second, it is redemptive. It is redemptive because it helps him break out of and overcome the loneliness, which is the hallmark of being Adam the Second. Thus, in crisis and distress, there was planted the seed of a new type of community. A new type of community. And what is that new type of community? When Adam the Second, or Adams the Second, come together, or when Adam the Second and his wife Eve come together, through sacrifice, through self-sacrifice, they form a new type of community, and that is the faith community, which reached full fruition in the covenant between God and Abraham. That's almost parenthetical because he doesn't get into it here. What does it mean, the relationship of the covenant of God and Abraham? But that's the first faith community. What does it mean to enter a covenant? That he'll discuss. The covenantal faith community, in contradistinction to the natural work community, the pragmatic community of Adam the First, the covenantal faith community interprets the divine pronouncement, Lo tov heyot adam levado, it is not good for man to be alone, not in utilitarian, but in ontological terms. Ontological, being, the nature of being. It is not good for man to be lonely, not alone. We're not talking about being alone. It's okay to be alone. It is not good for man to be lonely. Again, we've mentioned before, this is a very creative but homiletic reading of that pasuk. Lo tov heyot adam levado, Rabbi Soloveitchik says, it's not good for man to be lonely. With emphasis placed on to be. Being at the level of the faith community does not lend itself to any equation. To be is not to be equated with to work and produce goods, as historical materialism wants us to believe, to be is not identical with to think, as the classical tradition of philosophical rationalism throughout the ages, culminating in Descartes and later in Kant, tried to convince us. Remember, Descartes said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. The definition, the hallmark of man, is his ability to think. And for Rabbi Soloveitchik, like all good briskers, like all good Lithuanian rabbis, like all good rationalists, like all who admire the Rambam, place a lot of stock on cogito. Place a lot of stock on what it means to think. But remember, Rabbi Soloveitchik had said in the first chapter, Think Back, that the man of faith replaces cogito with credo. I believe, therefore I am. The hallmark of my being is my faith. To be does not exhaust itself either in suffering or in enjoying the world of sense. To be, these are all different philosophical definitions of what the very definition of humanity is, what the definition of being human is. What is to be? To be is a unique in-depth experience of which only Adam the Second is aware. And it is unrelated to any function or performance. To be means to be the only one, singular and different, and consequently lonely. The awareness of your singularity and your difference is the source of your loneliness, is the source of your knowledge that you are wholly unique. For what causes man to be lonely and feel insecure, if not the awareness of his uniqueness and exclusiveness? The I is lonely, experiencing ontological incompleteness and casualness, because there is no one who exists like the I. Meaning, I am lonely because I am the only I, and you are you. And my inner experience cannot ever be fully communicated to or understood by anyone else, just like their experience cannot be ever fully communicated to or understood by me. Since loneliness reflects the very core of the I existence experience, and is not an accidental modus, no accidental activity or external achievement, such as belonging to a natural work community and achieving cooperative success, can reclaim Adam the Second from this state. So, Adam the First's community, where we get together to accomplish something, there's a barn raising, we're all going to cooperate on something, we're going to build an intercontinental railroad, as an expression of the kivshua, of suppressing and conquering the world. Very good. That's fine. That's an act of creativity. It's part of what man is tasked with. It's the job of Adam the First. It's the path to majesty. It's the source of dignity. But it doesn't help us break out of the loneliness. This is what we discussed last time. The lonely crowd. Therefore, I repeat, Adam the Second must quest for a different kind of community. The companionship which Adam the Second is seeking is not to be found in the depersonalized regimentation of the army, in the automatic coordination of the assembly line, or in the activity of the institutionalized, soulless, political community. His quest is for a new kind of fellowship, which one finds in existential community. There, not only hands are joined, but experience as well. There, one hears not only the rhythmic sound of the production line, which might be the club of Adam the First, but also the rhythmic beat of hearts starved for existential companionship and all-embracing sympathy in experiencing the grandeur of the faith commitment. There, one lonely soul finds another soul, tormented by loneliness and solitude, yet unqualifiedly committed. The faith community is a community of commitment. Not people committed to each other, per se, but people all committed to a higher purpose. And that's what joins them. Because although I feel lonely, meaning I feel isolated, the barriers of my uniqueness prevent me from connecting with you, I can identify with you in one way. I recognize in you a commitment to something which I recognize in myself. And that becomes a basis of overcoming my loneliness and allowing us together to form community, but not the community of Adam the First, where we come together to accomplish something pragmatic, a faith community. Chapter 5. At this point, the main distinction between the natural community of Adam the First and the covenantal... Everyone out there? Nobody's been chatting. Okay. You're all very quiet tonight. Hold on a second. Turn on your cameras if you have them. Yes, I am lonely, but it's a different kind of loneliness. It's the loneliness of feeling you're talking out into the void and you're not sure there's someone else there. Which is interesting because one of the main themes in the work will later be the nature of prayer in the faith community. And that's probably, there's probably some resonance there. Chapter 5. At this point, the main distinction between the natural community of Adam the First, again, natural community, the pragmatic community, and the covenantal faith community of Adam the Second becomes clear. The first is a community of interests forged by the indomitable desire for success and triumph and consisting at times, at all times, of two grammatical personae, the I and the thou, who collaborate, me and you, who collaborate in order to further mutual interests. Now again, poor Adam the First gets a bad rap because compared to the sublimeness of Adam the Second, Adam the First comes across as a really unsympathetic character. But Rabbi Soloveitchik is not trying to be critical of him. He's being descriptive. And he admits that we, each of us, contain within ourselves a bit of Adam the First. A newcomer, upon joining the community, ceases to be the anonymous he and turns into a knowable, communicative thou. I can relate to you. I am I, and you are you, and together we can build a bridge. And that's a good thing. The world needs bridges. The second is a community of commitments, but the community of Adam the Second is a community of commitments born in distress and defeat and comprises three participants. Adam the First is I and thou. Two people come together. I start digging the tunnel from my end, you start digging your tunnel from your end, and we meet in the middle. But the community, the faith community of Adam II, has three participants. I, thou, and he. He with a capital H. God is invited into the equation. The he in whom all is rooted, and in whom everything finds its rehabilitation, and consequently, redemption. Redemption from, rescue from, the loneliness. Adam the First met the female all by himself. Adam the First didn't need a shadchan. Man and women are created simultaneously. While Adam the Second was introduced to Eve by God, who summoned Adam to join Eve in an existential community, molded by sacrificial action and suffering. I mean, literally suffering, because at least in the account as it's described in Genesis 2, a rib is taken out. There's a surgery goes on. But there's a sacrifice. Man has to give up of himself in order to gain an Ezer Kenegdo. And who himself became a partner in this community. So, again, Rabbi Soloveitchik doesn't, because the essay has this universalistic tone, he doesn't bring in rabbinic or Talmudic references within the body of the text. And even in the footnotes, they're really very sparse. But here we might hear, between the lines, the words of the Gemara, the words of the Midrash, that God serves as the Shadchan, God serves as the matchmaker. In the creation of children, there are three partners: man, woman, God. The Gemara asks, the Midrash asks, after God was done creating the world, what keeps him busy all day? Making shiduchim, helping the covenant of marriage, the covenantal community, the bond between man and woman going, that's God's involvement. And it's harder than the splitting of the Red Sea. All of these rabbinic notions, you know, are whispering to us from between the lines here. And when this community between Adam and Eve is made, God himself joins the circle and becomes a member of the community. God is never outside the covenantal community. He joins man and shares in his covenantal existence. Finitude and infinity. Man is finite, God is infinite. Temporality and eternity. Creature, created, and creator become involved in the same community. And he's fully aware that this is paradoxical. They bind themselves together and participate in a unitive existence. The element of togetherness of God and man is indispensable for the covenantal community. The presence of God in the covenant is definitional. For the very validity of the covenant rests upon the juridic halachic principle of free negotiation. That we enter it of our own free will. When one joins a covenant, when you make a deal, when business partners agree to something, it has to be done through the free will of each side. Mutual assumption and duties, and full recognition of the equal rights of both parties concerned with the covenant. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. In the footnotes here, Rabbi Soloveitchik tries to deal in a pretty interesting way with the idea of the Gemara, which may be familiar to you, that at Har Sinai, when the covenant between God and the Jewish people is made, there's a level of force involved. Kaf aleihem har kegigit, that God holds the mountain above our heads, held the mountain above our heads, and forced us to accept the covenant of Sinai. And he tries to explain why that's not a contradiction to what he's saying here. You're welcome to look at the footnotes. Both parties entering a covenantal relationship possess inalienable rights which may only be surrendered by mutual consent. When a covenant is made, it's a compact relationship. Both sides are drawn in. It's now the 150th anniversary of the Civil War going on now, so there's a lot of attention paid to the Civil War. This was essentially Lincoln's position, that the covenant of the states that form the Union, once the Union is made, there is no such possibility for secession. Once the ingredients are mixed together, you can't put them back into a centrifuge and separate them out into their component parts. Once the Union is made, it cannot be dissolved. The paradoxical experience of freedom, reciprocity, and equality in one's personal confrontation with God is basic for the understanding of the covenantal faith community. that on a certain plane, we are in a covenantal relationship with God. We are the chosen people. He chose us, and we chose him. That there is free will. And that's foundational to our sense of how it works. In the earlier footnote, let me go back a second. This question of God being a member of the covenant himself, he doesn't stand outside the community looking in, but he's part of it. Here in the footnote, referring to Tehillim chapter 91, Apostle in Tehillim chapter 91, the Tehillim we say, Yoshev Beseter Elyon, a kind of description of God and his characteristics. The whole concept of Imo Anochi Betzara, that God, speaking here, God will is with us, him, with the Jewish people in their trouble. What does it mean? When the Jewish people are in trouble, God is in trouble. If we're in a thicket, he's there with us. So how could that be? That can only be understood within the perspective of the covenantal community, which involves God in the destiny of the fellow members. That if we make a compact, if one guy's in trouble, we're all in trouble. You know, like that old metaphor of the people in the rowboat, one person's drilling a hole under his seat, and everybody says, "What are you doing? We'll drown." He says, "No, don't worry, I'm only drilling it under my own seat." No, it doesn't work that way. Like the other idea of, like, in other words, if the left hand is cut, does the right hand not feel it? That we're one organic unit. We are united together with God, and that's the idea, that he's also with us in our troubles. Not that God suffers psychologically, physically, in the manner that a human being does, but that we become somehow united. We meet God here at the top of page 43. We meet God in the covenantal community as a comrade and fellow member. Of course, even within the framework of this community, God appears as the leader, teacher, and shepherd. It's not that we're equal. Yet the leader is an integral part of the community. The teacher is inseparable from his pupils. And the shepherd never leaves his flock. They all belong to one group. The covenant draws God into the society of men of faith. The God before whom my fathers did walk, the God who has shepherded all my life, God was Jacob's shepherd and companion. The covenantal faith community manifests itself in a threefold personal union. I, thou, and he. But there's something significant here. There is no option of a one-on-one covenantal faith community. Me and God. Me and God involves the thou. I and he. I meaning me, and he meaning God. It also involves the thou. Now it's true that Rabbi Soloveitchik had mentioned this idea of the original faith community between Abraham and God. But immediately Abraham goes out on this effort to draw other people into this covenant, because it is a covenant that works vertically, and because of the vertical connection, that enables a horizontal connection. That each of us connects with God, and that relationship enables us to overcome our loneliness and to create community with others. Rabbi Soloveitchik will shortly get into the question of, if we are in this kind of intimate relationship with God, an almost mutual relationship with God, what is the nature of that relationship? Well, it's a relationship where we can communicate. And he describes communication which is initiated by God to us in the form of nivuah, in the form of prophecy, and the relationship, the communication, which is initiated by us to God in the form of prayer. But since prayer is a communal activity as well as an individual activity, that also forms as an activity of the faith community. And that too is something which helps us overcome the isolation of loneliness. Any thoughts, any questions? Last week everybody had so much to say that we only got through half the material. Okay. So I will cut it short here. I recommend reading on in chapter 6. And we'll do that next week again on Shivasar B'Tammuz, on either after or during the fast, depending upon where you are. And I think we have, including next week, I think we have three more sessions before the break later in August, and then we'll continue. As I said, I'm happy to get your feedback. Either now or by email. Let me see, what's this question here? Could you quickly explain the catharsis again? I have read the article. So, catharsis. We're going to come back to the catharsis. It's going to play more of a role. But the idea of something here, the covenantal relationship, the faith community, which lifts us out of our suffering, lifts us out of our pain, lifts us out of our isolation. That itself is cathartic. It's redemptive, right? It helps us solve that problem that we have. It's not exactly. It's probably not. I don't know enough about psychoanalysis to say it. I'm sure it's not identical to the way the term is used there. And it's not even here in Lonely Man of Faith, it's not exactly identical with the way he describes catharsis in the essay by the name Catharsis. Now that's partially because here he's writing in a universalistic tone, and in that essay by the title Catharsis, he's talking in a more very specifically Jewish halachic context where commitment to the halacha itself is cathartic, is purifying, is redeeming, is cleansing, because we are giving over part of our autonomy by being committed to a code of law. But the engagement in the mitzvot themselves are purifying. He describes it there. I mean, he's quoting the Gemara, but it's purifying in the sense that it's refining refining chemicals removes impurities. Do you need catharsis to join the covenant? No. In other words, the joining the community is the source of the catharsis. Being a member of the covenant is the source of the catharsis. It's what redeems you. It's what solves your, breaks down the loneliness, breaks down the isolation. Okay.